CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, in our new issue, we take a look at 100 stars who started their career in soaps. And the list is totally astounding. I mean, first of all, kudos to you who put the bulk of it together. But it's really incredible how many big names on the list, you know, came from the 70s and 80s, from like James Earl Jones to Morgan Freeman to Tommy Lee Jones to Meg Ryan. And then you have a slew of current stars, you know, Kelly Ripa, Shamar Moore, Justin Hartley, who all have early soap credits on their resume. And, you know, I think soaps so often get a bad rap for not having like a certain caliber of talent. And really, it could not be further from the truth. And this list totally proves that.
You know, as a side note, a lot of the more established names on that list also really underscored to me what a loss it is not to have any New York-based soaps anymore. Because particularly in the early days of soaps, the shows really managed to pull in a lot of extraordinarily talented actors who were in New York in pursuit of work in the theater and on Broadway. Mm-hmm. The shooting schedule of daytime allowed actors to be in the studio during the day and on stage at night. And this list that we put together boasts people who have Tony Awards, Primetime Emmys, and Oscars to their name. Even in the final years of the New York shows, a lot of superb talent emerged there, from Michael B. Jordan, who was Reggie on All My Children and is a superstar now with Creed and Black Panther, to Jesse Soffer and Billy Magnuson from As the World Turns. Jesse, who played Will, now stars on Chicago PD, and Billy, who played Casey, has himself been nominated for a Tony. But I've always felt sort of like a sense of pride when someone makes it big, when we as soap fans knew them first. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely feel that way. I mean, look at Jensen Ackles, whose first big role was His Days as Eric, and now is the star of the like uber successful Supernatural on the CW and has a rabid fan following around the world. You know, that couldn't make me happier. You know, we talked about Kelly Ripa, and then there's Mark Consuelos, and I remember Kelly holding court after one of the Soap Opera Digest Awards and just like telling such funny stories. You know, she was such a natural. And I can really say it came as no surprise to anyone who ever interacted with her that she was tapped to be the host of Live. You know, I will say that it's kind of interesting that you don't see as many actors these days transitioning. I do not think that it's a comment at all on the talent, because there are many actors who I could see in movies or primetime. But I think the jobs are just really harder to get now.
I think that's true. The traditional casting model for both television and movies has really been upended by everything from changes in technology, like so many auditions going from being in an actual room to being done by a video, to streaming services, to the rise of reality TV and specialized cable networks that offer alternatives to scripted programming. It's tough out there. It's always been tough out there, but it's like tough in a different way than it used to be. So I do think a lot of actors who have a coveted steady gig in daytime are loath to give it up, to risk their livelihood, to see what else is out there. And we're also seeing a flow in the other direction, right, where actors who have been successful in other fields who may not have considered a soap gig 20 years ago are now doing so, like a Denise Richards or a Wayne Brady coming to B&B.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm always struck by the reaction that those stars who never did soaps but who have done other mediums have when they come to soaps. I mean, the work is no joke. They're shooting, you know, sometimes 8 episodes in 5 days, and you really have to be on your game. You know, Tisha Campbell, who recently filmed on B&B, told us that she was so excited to do soaps because she had never done them before and has now basically told everyone she knows about how good the actors are and about how challenging challenging the gig is, you know? And then it's funny because then the other way, when actors leave soaps, they tell us that filming like a few pages a day is hard in its own way because they're so used to working at a certain level and discipline.
Yeah, related to that, we also hear from actors who've been away from daytime that it's sort of a shock when they come back and are reminded of just how quickly it moves. Mm-hmm. Like, I just had that conversation with Jeffrey Vincent Parise, who's joined YNR, and our guest today, Michael E. Knight, who was on All My Children for decades as Tad, quite successfully, might I add, with 3 daytime Emmys to his name, said that he was totally intimidated when he got his first GH script for his new role, Martin, because along with the script comes the schedule for the day. And that piece of paper literally tells you in black and white all the items that are being shot in that one day. And it kind of drives home how much there is to accomplish and how critical it is that you know your lines and be ready to go when it's time for your first and, you know, your boss's hope, your only take.
Yeah, I mean, it must be intimidating no matter how many Emmys you have and no matter how good you are, which he certainly is. So let's get him on the phone to hear more about it and his past on All My Children and more. Hi, Michael.
Hey.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we are so excited to talk to you today, and we are going to start by taking a walk down memory lane to your very first daytime role.
Great. I mean, I'm a pretty boring person, I have to admit. So,
oh, we don't believe that.
At this point, General Hospital sort of is anybody's guess. It's fun. It's great. It's been very surprising. But you know, definitely, memory lane is my strong suit at this point.
Okay. Well, then let's go back to 1982 when you were cast on All My Children, fresh out of school. So, first of all, tell us how you got the role of Tad.
It was just, I think it was at that point, it was an open call. I was I'd gone to a conservatory in New York for a couple of years, a Circle in the Square, and I was working with a very small agency doing commercial work. And I think that it literally was one of those things where they had a double-sided desk in the middle of the office. And there was, in those days, I mean, we had some film, but not a lot. We had a tremendous amount of commercial work, especially for young actors. We had commercial work, we had theater, and we had soap opera. And the woman that handled television sat directly across from one of the commercial agents. It was the Joan White agency. And they don't exist anymore. Joan passed away years ago. And they had an open call. And those days, I think it was sort of for the fans of the show, it goes back to sort of Cliff and Nina, Greg and Jenny, that kind of period. And they were recasting the brother of Jenny Gardner. And I think he'd gone from being a younger brother to an older brother. And it was just sort of an open call. And I remember going through the process. And then it's like, oh, it's going really well. And they're going to screen test you for the show. And those days they actually did that. They bring in like 6-7 guys. And you would work with different people. I remember mine was with both Kim and Marcy Walker. But they put everything on hold. And at that point, I thought, okay, this is just their way of saying, don't call us, we'll call you. And they really did it. And they called us. I think they called me back. God, it was the winter. It was cold. I remember that. 1982. I think it was like in the very beginning of December I got cast. I think the date I did was December, I don't know, 15th to 20th, around there. And then my first air date was in 83, it was in January.
Well, that is certainly when I was watching. I will tell you, I remember you coming to the show.
Oh, really?
Quite vividly. Yes.
That
was my first show.
It's amazing the pull that it has, because it's gotten more sort of eccentric as I go along, because you meet people that for some reason watched the show for different reasons, but the amazing thing is people always remember where they were in their lives and why they got into it. Like, you meet people, it's like, oh, my grandmother got me into it, or we were in college and we used to watch, or I was in the hospital, I had an accident, or I was like, I had my first kid, and you know, I got, and they can tell you exactly the storyline that sort of roped them into the show. And sort of, it's amazing to see how specific it is. And I think that's part of that's the one thing I think people always underrate about the soaps is that we're very easy to make fun of because there's seven basic stories, and Aggie used to say there's, you know, seven basic stories. Everything is a variation on a theme, and there's just so many times that, you know, you can marry the same woman, or your children will be stolen by gypsies or something. You know, God only knows, or you have amnesia. But for some reason, people, it has this very sort of familial, tactile kind of, people have this really very strong reaction to it. And it draws them back to a very, very specific part of their life. And they're always really, really kind about it. So gracious. And I think that's part of the reason why they keep a dinosaur like me around, you know? we're going around. I mean, I was stunned by what happened with GH because I have to say that it's all credit goes to Frank and to Dan and Chris, because I mean, I called Frank. I mean, I was like, I wanted to work. I needed to work. I'm bored. And if you've got anything, and he went to those, to Dan and Chris, and he said, well, you know, we got this lawyer. You want to come do that? And I was blown away that there was a sort of a fan reaction that they sort of, because, you know, my children was, what, 90? I've asked you this before.
Eight years in September was the anniversary.
8 years ago. Okay, yeah. I always go around and around about this because I forget the move. I think the move was in December of 2009 or 2010. But I mean, it was a long time ago. So, I mean, I'm amazed and honored that there's, like I say, the fans are always, they're always the thing that people underestimate. But they're the most wonderful thing about the job because it's just an incredibly unique audience. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like the fact that they would go, oh, Michael Knight's still alive. You know, they give you a chance after, I don't know many too many actors in other parts of the business that can say, hey, you know, I really would like to work. Is there anything available? And because of the audiences out there, like, oh yeah, we got this, you know, we got a lawyer for you. And that's sort of the way this thing evolved.
Mm-hmm. So I know Steph was watching All My Children when you first started. I started watching, I remember, like, basically my first episode had to do with, like, Ted and Dixie preparing to get married. So it's totally true. You remember exactly, like, when you started. But I was aware even then of this, like, iconic Tad, Liza, Marion storyline. So Tad sleeping with mother and daughter.
Yeah.
Do you remember, like, feeling at the time, like, wow, this is a hit? Or were you too new to kind of recognize maybe that it's kind of rare that your first big story is going to end up being such a smash?
Both. That's a great question. In those days, they brought you along. You know what I'm saying? It's like they didn't just throw you into storylines or sink or swim. They would, like, sort of, they just bleed you in slowly. We used to call them coffee scenes, where basically they would introduce you in phases to the audience and sort of set you up against different people on the campus and see how you reacted, and then they start writing for that. And I just lucked into, I think part of the luck that I had was Marcy Walker. I mean, Marcy and Kim and Larry were just so, I can't even tell you. I mean, I did an appearance. God, I think I've been on the show for not even a year. It was with Dorothy Lyman. I think Darnell was there, played Jesse, and Kimmy and played Jenny. And it was in Chicago. And I kid you not, for a guy that was sort of a wallflower growing up, it was like we almost started a riot on, I forgot the name of the street. It's sort of the commercial. We ended up going to a restaurant or doing something there. And I mean, the response just blew me away. I was calling, you know, my mom and my dad going, I literally felt like I was Elvis for the day, you know? So they hooked me up with Marcy as God's vengeance for being mean to my sister. And Jennifer Bassey was just one of the sweetest people of all time. Funniest women I've ever worked with, just a brilliant comedian. They gave us this thing where it's sort of like, and it's like, okay, sleeping with mother and daughter. But of course, the wind up is that, you know, basically it's a woman who's in a very wealthy marriage, bored, and you know, did she, and the doc, they just happen to, and the guy is kind of a gigolo, doesn't want to get, doesn't want to work for a living, you know, would rather make money the easy way, you know, and these things. They hook us into this three-way thing, and it just it exploded. And I am still I have to smile when I think about the audience reaction, because when guys sidle up to you on the subway, you know, and you're just sort of riding up and down Broadway on the 1-2 or the 1-3 or whatever, some guy sidles up to you, goes, and kind of under his breath goes, you know, I'm a lot like Ted. You kind of got to go, that's not a good thing. but it was, and the thing that made it just absolutely just the gravy on top was Jackie Babin. Jackie was my producer, who I just adored. She's been gone for years. Jackie goes all the way back to, I think, Streetcar Named Desire. She was one of the producers. She worked in production on that when it was first on Broadway. But anyway, so Jackie allowed me to be funny, because originally the character as God's Vengeance on Liza was kind of just a jerk. And I was never very cocky growing up. So that was kind of hard for me to do. So I kind of went to Jackie and said, can he be funny? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, there are all these like sort of little there in those days specifically, I think Mar and I've talked about this once, how the genesis, what All My Children was like back in the day before Agnes left versus now. And there was still room for like some really broad comedy. We used to do all these fantasy episodes and stuff like that. And I said to Jackie, I said, you know, this guy, there's certain parts of soap that lend itself to kind of sitcom stuff. And can I make him funny? You know, and she said, yeah, well, just show us what you got. And it just exploded from there. I really had no idea how lucky I was until, 20 years later. I still kind of marvel how stupid lucky I was at the same time. Because I was like, 23 at that time? You know, so it was a baby.
Did you ever think that the nickname Tad the Cad would just have such a life that it had? And still today, people can say it and know exactly what you're talking about?
I've grown into it. It used to bother me because I thought, you got to remember back in the day, do you guys remember the soap characters had these just amazing names like Blade, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And like Blade and, you know, it's just these like really macho names. And here's this, you know, Tad. And it's like, to me, I always thought Tad sounds like a snack. You know, like nacho cheese Tad, you know, sugarless Tad. It sounds like something it's made out of corn you pull out of a bag. You know what I mean? So, but I've grown to love it. I really have. I mean, it's just taken on a life of its own. Yeah, I it's like, because I went from Tad the Cad to Tad the Dad to right. Tad the Granddad.
Right.
You know?
I know. I feel like his caddishness, you know, kind of like ended more or less in the 80s. It's so unfair that he kept being a cast aspersions.
Yeah,
as a
cad. That kind of that really cocky. But then again, I mean, and this is all credit to Agnes too. And I can't stress this enough, is in my estimation, the show really lost something when Agnes sold it off, because what people forget is Pine Valley was the place she always wanted to grow up. She said, you know, she says in her book, she said when she was alive, Pine Valley was the place I wanted to live and I never got a chance to. So Pine Valley, the place, was actually like a character. It was this small town where everybody left their doors, back doors open. And it was all about who's sleeping with who and, you know, who's doing what to who and who's winning. It's sort of like, it was basically a town about small town, a show about small town gossip, basically. Mm-hmm. And so a character like Tad, you know, if you take a character like that and put him in a city, he's just a jerk. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't know, I don't want to swear on your show, but, you know, it's like, he's an idiot. You know what I mean? But in a small town, for some reason, set against a sort of our town type canvas, where it's like, you know, the kid that just like, you know,
he's a cocky, he's lucky, he was an adopted kid, he's a bit of a troublemaker. You know, everybody sort of in a small town remembers the rebel in high school, you know what I mean? Rather than, you know, you take that character and you put him in a different place, he's just a jerk. And again, it was just pure luck that, you know, at that Agnes was really at the height of what she was doing, put me in this place. I was surrounded by absolutely brilliant people. I mean, just Dorothy Lyman, I remember, you know, she used to blow me away because she was so good at really broad comedy, but based in character. And I remember talking to her about it and how, you know, I just was like, God, you know, we got one day, we got a couple hours to put this together. How do you get the courage to do it? And I remember her basically in so many words saying, honey, ain't no point in having it in the store if you don't put it in the window. So she was the one that really sort of said, yeah, if you want to, like, you want to push out the walls on this character a little bit, do it. But again, it was like literally pure luck. It was winning the lottery.
We're both grinning because we're with you. So in addition to getting encouragement from Dorothy, who were your other early mentors working on All My Children?
Oh, God, there's so many.
I want to hear a Kay Campbell story.
Oh, she was wonderful. She was so sweet. Kay, as you, was grand. Basically, she was Tad's paramour. She was my hero. She kept me out of trouble. She was sort of the North Star of the Martin family. So what I used to say is the cameras are pointed in the wrong direction, because what we would do, you know, the pressure of basically putting something that's high camp, that's high drama, this melodrama on every day has its own stresses. So consequently, the dress rehearsal was the funniest damn thing you have ever seen in your life, because it was all of us knowing that if we were going to bust on or break somebody up or screw with somebody or make a comment on what we thought was bad writing at the time, could go off. So one of the greatest things I used to love watching, I was telling this to Jessica Tuck the other day at because she was on in the studio, is we used to watch each other because you got a sense of who somebody was, but then we would watch their dress rehearsal and it was hysterical. Well, one of my first days working with Kay and Ray McDonough, who I adored, mm-hmm. played my father, is they basically, Tad is in trouble. I'm in the back seat of the car of the family jalopy. Ray McDonald and Kay are basically, they've come to bail me out of something. I forgot what it was or like, and they're basic. And Kay is sticking up for Tad, leave the boy alone. Ray is like, wants to have his skin, blah, 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 blah. Well, during dress rehearsal, Kay and Ray are swearing at each other, like in a blue streak. She's like, Oh, leave the poor boy alone, you know. And Ray turns around and says, shut up, you old bat. You're always sticking up for little bastard. I hate him. I'm going to leave him in a bus station. You know what I'm saying? It's like, take the clothes off. He doesn't deserve a damn thing. You know, you're not, shut up. I'm going to leave you. You're senile, for God's sake. I'm going to leave you on the, I'm leaving you at the next flight. And they're going off at each other like, and I'm in the back, and I'm this new kid on the show. I had no idea what I got. I was laughing until I couldn't keep a straight face. And the thing is, Ray used to be so damn funny. And what happens is we go for notes, and then we come back and we tape the show, and I'd still be remembering how funny he was during the dress rehearsal, and I just start laughing. And of course, he had that sort of Mount Rushmore face, and you know. And he would sort of, he'd look at me like, what's wrong with you, young man, kind of thing. But that was my Kay Campbell story, because, you know, on the show, she looked like she knit for a living. And she was really, first off, she'd been in television for years and years, and you should tell about doing live TV and stuff like that. She was one of the original characters on the show. And she was just, you know, like I say, I was surrounded by brilliant, generous, genius people. I mean, in those days, we were still amazed that we could put 43, 44 minutes of videotape on the air every day. I mean, it was like, you know, delivering the mail at a dead run.
Well, tell me, is there a period of time on All My Children that you would consider like the golden age of Tad?
That's a good question. There were two, I think. The golden age would be what you brought up, Stephanie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was, I think the intro, you know, that whole Liza Marion thing, because it was sort of like, I was so lucky. I had no idea because, boy, what an intro in the show. And then the other second one I'd say would be sort of like the Tad and Dixie stuff, you know, when they first got us together because, and I mean, there are other people in soaps that can speak to this because being part of a super couple is a blessing and a curse because you never know when you're going to catch lightning in a bottle and then the audience digs it, but then it has its sort of own gravitational pull. You know what I mean? And so the audience, they kind of work for the show. They keep coming back. They watch every day. They want to see what happens on Monday. So you never can get, if you're part of a super couple, it's kind of hard to pull away, to do something, to grow, to go in another direction. But I think Katie was so young. She was like 19 when we first, and there was one show. And I don't think we were supposed to be together. I think there was, what was the name of that boutique, the dress boutique that Myrtle used to own? I can't remember the name of it.
Oh my God, we're both looking at each other and it's torturing.
Was it not the boutique?
She owned, there was a dress shop. And there was like, you know, there was like the Glamorama.
Right.
Yeah.
And there was like the Country Club. And there was like, there was Foxy's. I mean, there were these set pieces that you always recognize. Well, anyway, Myrtle used to own this shop. I can't remember the name of it. And they basically put me in a scene with Katie because she was sort of a kid from the wrong side of the tracks. And I was this ne'er-do-well. And it was sort of like the two orphans meet each other, you know, on a chance meeting. And they went and it just happens. There's that like lightning moment and they go, okay, let's follow this. And the next thing you know, I mean, it was like, God, Katie, by the time the show went down, they brought her back from the dead a second time. And they didn't even bother trying to explain why, you know what I mean? It's just like, well, Tad and Dixie together forever. Got to send them off to the sunset together. It's like, you know, give the audience a break. But I just, you know, but I'd say those are the two. Those are the two sort of the glory days. Because then it becomes sort of a variation on a theme. And the thing I think that basically saved the character, Mara and I have talked about this too, is the humor that Jackie let me bring in the 80s. Because there were definitely people who were running the ship, so to speak, in those last 10 years that would just assume just of cut me adrift. And it was the audience that sort of forbade it. You know, and I think that the one thing that I still had to offer audience was, I think, of this sort of innate sense of humor of the character.
A couple things. Number one, there would have been riots in the streets had they let Michael Knight go as Tad. I'm saying right now that would have been huge, like front page news on every newspaper. Number two, I'm here to tell you that the boutique was called The Boutique. I looked it up.
The Boutique.
Yep.
There you go.
Thirdly, I feel like you just saw Katie McLean at her birthday party. Is this correct? We saw a tweet.
I did.
Could you please tell us about that and how long had it been since you last saw her?
Katie and I stay pretty, you know, we talk to each other, you know, once every 6 months, once a year, something like that. We stay pretty good because we're really close. I mean, we grew up, I had 10 years on her, but, you know, we grew up around each other basically. And we just watched each other evolve. But I mean, last time I saw Katie, we had lunch at a French restaurant on Ventura.
Did anyone recognize you together? Were they like, oh my God, Tad and Dixie are here in the restaurant?
No. That would have been it would have been very, very interesting to see. But a lot of years, a lot of water under the bridge. Yeah. But it's like, I'm stunned that it's been that long. But no, we've been through a lot. I've seen her go through a lot. I really am. I mean, Katie's an amazing person, amazing actress, but she, you know, she's the breadwinner for her family for a long time. She went through her mother's illness and death and stuff. She bore a lot on her shoulders at a very young age with a lot of dignity. So, she's walked me as a friend through some pretty hairy times in my life too. So, I mean, I think there's something about, and also it's also something about the, it's hard to explain soap operas to somebody in the business. It's hard to explain it to somebody on the outside because it's sort of a job that if you're not careful can eat your life. It demands a lot. You know, it's constantly ongoing, but you never forget people. I mean, like another one that people that I'll never forget. It was so good to spend a little time on Young and the Restless because Peter Bergman was like an icon, you know, like Cliff and Nina. I remember being in an airport with Taylor Miller and it was just, it's kind of funny to watch from, you know, the outside. She couldn't go to the bathroom without somebody like running up to her and getting an autograph. It's just amazing. So Peter, Palmer Courtland, Jimmy Mitchell, Taylor and Peter, they were all massive on the show. And Peter was just, he was, God, such an amazing guy, you know, although even as a young, much younger man back then, you know, he was a wonderful gossip. He's one of the best raconteurs I've ever known to tell a mean story. And he would be like, you know, he loves the dish, as he calls it. And he would sort of go up to, and he had all these like little quotes that he would throw at you, like, you know, the Chinese proverbs, like a man with great dish never eat alone kind of thing. and sort of come up. And then, so, you know, then he peels off and he goes and he starts, you know, with Jack on the Young and the Restless. And now he's just, I mean, you have to talk about an icon of daytime. Mm-hmm. But I go back to, you know, I see him and it's just, I run up, throw my arms around him and stuff. And you know, cause I go back to the days when he was like the next dressing room over, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We had these tiny little dressing rooms on 67th Street that we shared with somebody else. I mean, these things were clawed. They were small.
Who were your roommates?
I had Ray McDonald for a while. I had, and my longest running on 67th Street was David Canary, and who was, boy, I tell you, that still brings, I don't know, that is sad. That's to me. I mean, he was something else, man. He was the most amazing actor and the most humble guy, and he was sort of like one of the foundations of that show for so long, and the fact that he passed away so quickly after the show was over, just, I never get over it, because if there was a guy that deserved to go fishing, it was David, because he was just, I mean, he was so good. I remember watching him do a scene. God, I think we were doing the AIDS storyline and his wife was named Cindy. I think. Mm-hmm. And he's acting out a story on split screen with Adam. So it's Stuart and Adam, and Stuart is basically grieving the loss of his wife. And you got to remember that between that, these little fractions of time where they're breaking back and forth, there's like 2 hours where it's like, you know, he goes, he's got to do his redo his makeup, redo his hair, change his wardrobe, come back, run lines to get into character with the person that plays the back of his head. I forgot the name of the man that did it. But then, and then you edit together a scene that wins an Emmy. I think he won 3 of them, 4 of them. And I remember seeing the scene seeing it again at the Emmys, looking up on the screen and they're saying, you know, nominees are, and then they show this scene. And I knew before they, you know, opened the envelope, I said, he did it again. He won again. I mean, the guy was, he was just magic, you know? Anyway, I used to remember he used to torture me because way back in the day before they were even a thing, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles had come out, and they were, at that point, they were a graphic novel, and they had these really great stores. There was a store called Forbidden Planet, I think it was, a store downtown in Manhattan, and they had these plastic figurines, these little G.I. Joe things. Now, I thought these were the coolest things, and I didn't know anything about the Ninja Turtle, but I thought these were the coolest little figurines. And so I bought 4 of them, and I come in, and like, you got to remember, there's like, these are really small dressing rooms, you know? And there's like one shelf, and I put these things up there, and he was just to say, why do we need toys in our dressing room? It's like, you realize, you
you know, this does not bode well for us. We have toys in our dressing room. Back in the day, it was really, man, it was really something, I have to say. I started and, God, I was in New York City. I was 23 years old. You know, I just got fresh out of school. I was making a living doing what I wanted to do in a business that was still just going gangbusters. And I mean, I remember one of the big thrills of my life was meeting Tony and the Genie. And then Genie came over to do, I always felt like they were kind of cheated because she was, you got to understand, a house in college. And there were four women and me and two guys. And this is at Wesleyan. And Luke and Laura were going gangbusters. And I mean, half of the house didn't have classes on Friday, so the other half wouldn't have them on Monday. So we'd get together. And I remember the girls literally in the spring sunbathing and during General Hospital, they had this beach umbrella that they sawed in half and they stuck it in the ground. So you would just see their butts leaning up. They had this TV that they ran on an extension cord out from the kitchen window, and they would basically sunbathe. They would do their backs during General Hospital. So
that's amazing.
And I met Tony, and I made this small gacking noise in the back of my throat because I was like, it was like meeting an icon, and I was like Cliff Clavin in Cheers. And he came around. We were doing something, and he came around this table, and he said, Michael, how are you? God, you're doing so well. And he was like, my name is Tony, and anyway, that made my year, you know. And then we got Genie, and I can't remember the name of the character, but I think we got Genie for like a year and a half, two years.
Sierra Connor, Michael, was the name.
Sierra, yeah. And so for me, the greatest, she is one of the coolest ladies ever. Amazing sense of humor, just a sweetheart. And loved her husband, Jonathan. I was a big fan of him on Star Trek. Meeting him at the studio was really, really fun. But Jeannie used to tell us, you know, because back in the, she would tell us stories about what it was like to be on General Hospital when it was like, you know, number one with a bullet, and just the wild stuff that she'd been through at a very, very early age, you know. And I have to say, one of the things, the thrills of my life lately is to be able to walk onto the studio floor with like people like Tristan and Ken and Finola and just look at each other and you kind of grin going, yeah, you know, whole lot of water under that bridge. But these people they're still kicking. They've seen it change. They're still going gangbusters. Ken was a high school friend of my wife's back in Florida. You know, so I've known Ken Frazee. So it's kind of cool. I mean, there's a big familial aspect to it that I kind of wish I could relate to people, because it's a very small corner of the world. It really is. But, and you know, there's that joke that people on soaps don't die. They just change shows. You know? So.
Well, lucky for us.
Exactly. Okay. So I want to hear, your perspective, like it's been 8 years. We watched that final episode, and so many of us remember it so well. You had that beautiful speech to deliver. But what do you remember, not as Tad, but as Michael, like of being there on the set that day, the last day of taping All My Children?
Aggie. I just remember Aggie, Agnes. Mm-hmm. She was like, she was a real character. She's kind of hard to, you know, it's kind of, boy, I talk too much, so get going, man, another 20 minutes on Agnes. But just Aggie. I think Aggie never forgave herself for, you know, that's not true. I can't say that. I think she was always saddened by selling the show because, again, to Agnes, Pine Valley was as much a character as any character she put on it. She knew the place. And I think that at that point in her life, you know, she was saying goodbye to like one of her children, you know, and she wrote that, thank you for mentioning that wonderful, wonderful speech. That was, I always call it like the friends, neighbors, family speech.
Right.
And I was known to change a couple words here and there and stuff. And there wasn't one syllable in that. It was just so beautifully written. And I memorized it. And like, it took like 4 minutes to memorize. It was that
well written. And I walked up to her, there was this huge cake we had and stuff. And I went, Aggie, you wrote this, didn't this was you. This wasn't one of the dialogue. I mean, you didn't pass this off. This was you. And she said, yep. You know, that's my farewell. And she was, Agnes was the closest thing to God that we ever saw, because then she was, I remember feeling so protected, so loved, because I met, we were owned by Cap Cities, Warren Buffett. And Agnes brought Warren Buffett into the studio to introduce him around, to show you what they did. And Agnes was the size of the Lucky Charms elf. You know what I mean? She was like, she literally looked, she was so tiny, she looked like she jumped off a front of the boxes. And she introduced me to Warren Buffett, and I didn't know what to say. She goes, now this is Michael. This young man is Michael. He plays Tad on our show, blah, blah, blah. And Tad's been this and that, and he's sort of the bad boy in the show. And she reached up in front of Warren Buffett, and she pinched me on both cheeks, and she goes, and you're so good. And I just sat there. I felt like a trained poodle. I didn't know what to do. But she, see, in those days, Aggie just had, you know, Aggie had a, she had a sense of where things should go and, you know, how long it should take to get there. And, you know, she and Bill Bell, you know, they came up under Irma, you know, Irma Phillips and radio, and they were the pioneers that created like 90% of the daytime. And you got to remember, these two people had their hands in, you know, 80% of what at one point was 14 shows on the air, you know, and they were masters. They were just master craftsmen at what they did. And so that last day in Burbank, Glendale, I remember walking up to Aggie and just hugging her and say, Aggie, thank you for my life, you know. And that's just, it was really, really bittersweet. It really was. I kind of wonder, boy, I tell you, I wonder if Aggie had stayed. I think she earned the right. She earned, as I say, she earned the right to go fishing. But I wonder if she had not bowed out the creative aspect of the show, if we wouldn't have had another few years, because I definitely think that there were people, and I understood that there were reasons for it, because, you know, the market was changing, the world was changing, production was changing, you know, we had to adapt or die. But I definitely think there were some people running the show at the end that maybe weren't as inspired as they could have been, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, 8 years later, there's still a passionate fan base who would love to see this show back tomorrow. You know, what does it mean to you that it's had such an impact on so many people and so many fans?
I think there's part of, there's a whole cultural thing going on in, you know, in our world, you know, and I think that's kind of that wonderful. That vision that Aggie always had, which was like Pine Valley's a place you wanted to live when you were a kid. You know, it's just like everything felt safe. A lot of really bad stuff happened, but you knew it was all going to be okay. You know, it's a place where people left their back doors open at night. I think there's a lot, the world is changing. Like, Mara, did you ask me about, like, was it you that asked me about social media?
Asked you about social media.
Did you? I was like, somebody asked me about social media. Like, why are you not on social media? And I have to say, I'm a product of my age. I mean, I don't get it. It frightens me. You know what I mean? It's just like, okay, email. I'm good on email. That was my generation. You know, Twitter, I still don't get it. You know, and I think that devoted fan base, like having that real love of my children, like I say, you never forget where you were or what was going on in your life when you see one of us, because we take us right back. And there's a kind of that wonderful safety, kind of very beautiful, nostalgic feeling about what the show was, the people on it, how it was produced, you know, its place in the lineup, its place in the world. I mean, you know, anyway, I'll shut up.
Well, after All My Children, you did join Young and the Restless. So what are the highlights of your run as Simon Neville?
Eileen, mm-hmm. I loved Eileen cracked me up.
Eric, I didn't know what to expect. I really, you know, the highlights were, and also Television City. I'd never worked in a, because you got to understand, in New York, we worked in a studio, but it was, you know, it was on our in our building and towards the end. It was all my children. It was The View. But, you know, it was dedicated to basically one thing. CBS Television City was a proper television studio. And, like, I remember coming out of my dressing room for the day and turning to the right, and there's a picture of All in the Family on the wall, you know? Or, like, these pictures of the Carol Burnett Show. You know, and it's sort of like it was like walking around a living piece of history. It was really, really cool. But also the show itself was just the people on it were so lovely. And I didn't know what to expect, because each show has got its own kind of character. It's got its own personality. And Melody and Catherine Gawain. Melody was in my wedding, for God's sake. She was one of the bridesmaids.
Wow.
So there were people like Peter and I went back, like I say, you know, I can't say enough about what a gentleman Peter Bergman is. What a great, great guy. But Eileen was hysterical. I loved working with Eileen. I don't know how to describe it. She is a real character. And she, you know, she gave me, I do feel I dropped the ball a little bit, because initially, when they hired me, he was a character. It was kind of hard to explain. It was like, God, poor Christoph. That's another thing, working with Christoph. So many people. You understand, it's a very small industry. So basically, we cross-pollinate. So I know a lot of people from different places in that show. Eileen, I dropped the ball, because initially he was a character role. I was supposed to come in. He was supposed to be sort of like this bizarre medical genius that somehow saved Christoph's wife from this or that and the other thing. And they bled into that. They bled into it because Eileen, her character was sick, and it was all, I was involved in getting her well and stuff like that. But I realized too late that a better job would have been to be a love interest for her. So Neville was kind of like a nerd. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like hard to take somebody who's just drop dead like Eileen and sort of hook her up to this sort of lab poodle, which is sort of what Neville was. I wish, had I known that the character might have had legs, that I played him more straight rather than sort of over the top on a character basis. Mm-hmm. But I'd say I had a blast working with Eileen because it was a very distinct little corner of the show. So most of the stuff I did was with Eileen, and it was fun too, because, you know, she and Peter were family. So I got to do that. I never got to work with Eric, and I was always really kind of sorry about that, because Eric is hysterical. He's wonderful, and he's an icon. He's another one. He's like David Canary. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, he is the Mount Rushmore of daytime. And I would have wanted to be on, I would have wanted to share the screen with him just once.
I would have wanted that too.
Ditto.
All right. So let's get into GH a little bit. Now, I know from talking to you that you watched the show, you familiarized yourself with it a bit before you started working on it. Who are the folks that jumped out to you as, like, characters or actors that you really hoped you would get to cross paths with on screen?
God, that's a good question. Well, on a purely selfish basis, a personal basis, Patrick, Finola, Maurice, Laura, because I have history with them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I go back, Maurice and I go back to 88, and he's just grown into this, just, I mean, he's a powerhouse. I always love to brag on him, because I always say what most people don't know about is Maurice is a card carrying member of the Actors Studio. And if you know how hard it is to get in the Actors Studio, it's no joke, you know? And there's a reason he is who he is. I mean, he is like Sonny is that show, you know? He scares me a little bit, because if you cross, you know, if you cross his character, you end up in a doggy bag in Des Moines, you know what I mean? So, I would not be. That's like being married to Susan Lucci. You know, you're not destined to be around for too long.
Finola and I go way back, years and years and years. Laura, I knew when she was just, again, just become this amazing actress. I just love watching her and Maurice tear it up on screen. I really do. I was watching them have a fight on the show in the kitchen set. And the one thing I couldn't tear myself away is why they have a bowl full of tribbles in the front.
Oh, that's not the only question.
Why is there a bowl full of tribbles in front of them?
We don't know. Every fan writes in about that, just
Michael,
so you know.
Michael, the real question is, why haven't you found out the answer to that? You're on that set. Go track someone down.
I haven't been around long enough. But in terms of, Patrick is one of my oldest, dearest friends. I'd love to work with Rebecca. I have to say, it's an amazing, it really is an amazing cast. The weird things about the fact that there are only four shows now, it's almost like they cut away a lot of the fat in the industry. I don't know how to explain it. So people are really, really good at what they do. I already got to, selfishly, I hope I get to do more of it because he is brilliant. Getting to work with Roger was really fun because he's a devoted character actor on daytime. It's like, that's a very unique thing. I remember Catherine coming home because Catherine, when we were married, was big soap opera maven. She knew everybody. She knew it. Like she watched the show. She studied it. She loved the medium. And I remember her coming home in like 96 because I remember we were in our second apartment on 79th Street in Broadway. She said, "There is a kid." And I mean kid, he was at that point, I think he was in his mid-20s, on One Life to Live, who was just tearing it up. I mean, you have to watch this kid. And again, I mean, he was a bad boy. And she said, watch this, they're going to screw it up. I think it was Todd Manning. He's a powerhouse actor, but they're going to try to turn him into a good guy. And, you know, watch what happens kind of thing. And so I've known of and been a fan of Roger's for just centuries. So, I mean, it was really, really wonderful. It's been wonderful to be on set with him and do some stuff. I love, on a professional level, I'd love to work with Michael Easton. I think Michael Easton is like one of those guys that's just, you never catch him acting ever. I mean, he's just absolutely silky. He's seamless. He's got this just innate dignity to everything I've ever seen him do. And I remember, God, I include watching him play a vampire, you know, years ago on Poor Charles. So, I mean, this is a hard answer. I'm sorry. This is Stephanie. This is a hard question for me to answer because I mean, there's so many people. I mean, you could throw a dart. I hope I get to cross paths with Anna Devane because, you know, she's a big deal. But then there are other people on the show that I think that I don't know that I haven't worked with that I think are doing such incredible work. I love Danelle Curtis. Mm-hmm. I love his stuff. I think he's brilliant. The kids are wonderful. Cameron, Joss, I think, you know, it's a really, really good cast of people. I'd be lucky to work with anybody at this point, really. Who am I kidding?
Well, Michael, we were not the only ones with questions for you. So we actually reached out to a few of your friends, and they had a few things that they wanted to ask. So the first question that we have for you here comes from your friend Patrick, who fans know as James Patrick Stewart.
Well, I know as Big Nose, yes.
You know as Big Nose, okay. He wants Big to Nose. Know, between you and General Hospital's James Patrick Stewart, who's a better chess player? Give examples, be specific.
That is so mean. Oh God, that's so mean. He just absolutely, we ended up, Patrick, this is a long story. Patrick ended up going on my honeymoon. I don't know how to explain it other than Catherine and I, we got married, didn't have a lot of two dimes to rub together. We go back to New York. It's like, okay, terrific. We're going to, we were settled. I was on the show. I don't think she was on Loving yet. We were going to, maybe she was, we were going to take a honeymoon that we never took. So it was a first class all expenses paid kind of thing, you know, first down to Four Seasons on. At that point, Nevis doesn't exist anymore. It's taken out by a hurricane, unfortunately. Beautiful, beautiful place. So I had to cancel it twice. I mean, like, I think she got a show she couldn't get away from, but might have been Loving. And then she ended up, the next year came around, she was doing Fantine on Broadway. She was doing Les Mis. So at that point, the resort said, you're going to lose your pot. Like, you know, we're sorry. I mean, it's been 12 months. You got to walk away from it. You got to eat it. So I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I called Patrick and I said, do you want to go on my honeymoon? He was like, what's the catch? You know what I mean? He's like, I said, no catch. I don't want to blow the money. Come on. The Four Seasons went down and it was, you know, a small island, not a lot to do. He insisted on running around the resort in a Speedo, which I was like, I was just wondering what all of the fans on the island thought, you know, like Tad Brink comes down with his boy toy and we would sit and play chess. There was like a game room and Patrick was like, oh, let's, what do you think? You want to play chess? And at this point I had no idea knowing he's really good. And he just would just absolutely mop the floor with me. But and I was just playing again and again and again and again. And it got to the point where I was just like, I knocked the board over. I got so frustrated. So short answer is he is by far.
Well, our other pressing query comes from Rebecca Budig, as listeners know as GH's Hayden. She would like to know, how do you get your hair so thick and lustrous?
She is like, okay, I have to say that Rebecca is one of the people who's responsible for Rebecca Patrick and my friend Lindsay Harrison. We're responsible for me even appearing on General Hospital because I, like I said, I wanted to work and I needed to work. And so I reached out to them and I said, would I be out of bounds to reach out to Frank, to write Frank an email and go, hey man, do you want to do some stunt casting? Look, Michael Knight's still alive. Do you want to, you know, put him in Port Charles? And so Rebecca is largely responsible for me. And she was like, absolutely do it. You know, got nothing to lose. So she's responsible for me being on the show. And this is kind of a running thing with, she and I are also in an acting lab together. We both study under just a brilliant, brilliant teacher by the name of Lee Kilton Smith, who's here in Los Angeles. He's just a genius. And we do character work. And most people don't, I wish people could see Rebecca do character work because she really is absolutely just a genius. Well, unfortunately, one of the shots that my acting teacher always, you know, throws at me is my hair, because I have soap hair. I'm just cursed with soap hair. And I'm glad to have it. I really am. It's on my head. I don't care what color it is. You know, there's still enough up there to play with. So, but she said, like, every time you do a character, you can't get it away. I mean, the running joke in my acting class is I looked like Colonel Sanders and Kenny Rogers had a baby. So.
Well, that's a blessing.
I would agree. We have not seen that much of Martin Gray, your new character, but I'm obsessed with him. And I want to know if you're open to, like, doing more than maybe just the initial few episodes that you were slated to do, like give a girl some hope.
Absolutely.
Here. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. I think it sort of surprised everybody. Again, all credit goes to Frank and Dan and Chris because I was the one who reached out to them and said, what do you think? And Frank's response is, I've known Frank for 25, not 30 years. I'm not quite sure. Frank knows this business. Like, I mean, there's a reason that General Hospital is still on the show because Frank knows, I think, from the ground up, he can do anything. He can edit, he can write, he's a brilliant director. Frank, one thing I know about him is guys will never promise anything he can't deliver. So I reached out to him and I go, stunt casting, what do you think? He goes, I have a lawyer. It's an encapsulated thing. What do you think? I mean, I went to Dan and Chris and they go, yeah, bring Michael to do it. And it was, I think it was at that point, 6 to 8 episodes. It was encapsulated. It was just an arc. And we sort of got to that place. And then Frank came back and said, do you want to, there's a chance that we can see an avenue
bleeding him into these other two possible stories. What do you think? And I was like, hell yeah. You know, so absolutely. I if they want me, you can be sure I'll be there.
Awesome.
Well, we certainly hope to see more of you. And we thank you so much for joining us today and telling such great stories.
I have to apologize. I'm cursed, actually. I've got the chatty gene. It comes from my grandmother, and I apologize if I'm long-winded.
No, you are not. We could talk to you all day.
Absolutely.
We only scratched the surface, seriously.
It's so true.
Thank you so much, and we hope to talk to you soon.
God bless you guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Michael.
Have a great day. Thank you, Michael.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Michael Knight for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.